Welcome to the Deaf Studies podcast, a podcast dedicated to the breadth and diversity of voices in and around the academic field of deaf studies.
With your hosts, Dr. Renske Visser and Dr. Bethan Michael Fox. Let's get started.
Hi, Renske, and good evening. How are you doing?
Good evening, good evening. I'm good. How are you, Beth?
Yeah, I'm okay, thank you. It's been a long day, busy weekend, but I've been looking forward to talking to you.
Same. And we thought to do something different this time, and we thought we would give a little bit of an update of some of the conferences that will happen this year. So some of them are UK-based and others are taking place elsewhere in Europe. Would you like to get started with one of yours?
Sure. So I'm going to start with an online conference, which is the CDAS, Centre for Deaf and Societies 2024 online conference, entitled Deaf and Communities. So that's on the 6th and 7th of June, and it's held online on the University of Bath's platform. They'll be looking at dying, death and bereavement in the context of communities, and taking communities in a really wide way to mean all sorts of different things, thinking about like social cohesion and social movements, climate change, deviant communities. They've got on their list community initiatives, research communities, diaspora migration, marginalized communities. So I'm really looking forward to that. Abstract deadline has passed for that one, and I know that I don't think the answers have come back yet. I'm not sure about whether people are in or out for that one. I think I've put something in as part of a group with somebody else about some writing work. And yeah, wait and see. But either way, I should be attending because it's usually pretty affordable and quite an interesting and engaging one. I really enjoyed it last year. We interviewed Tony Walter at it last year, didn't we? And that was pretty good. So do you think you'll be able to come to that one, Ned?
When was that?
6th and 7th of June.
Ooh, I might be able to join. I might be attending a summer camp then for Dutch school. I think that might be in the exact same week. So I might just be teaching. But otherwise, I will be there.
Yeah, I mean, I've got it in my diary. So I'm looking forward to it. It's a Thursday and a Friday. But yeah, fingers crossed. You can attend some of it online, also do Dutch school. Good old time zones. Let's see how it goes. Do you want to give me one of yours?
Yes. So one that's happening in October in my backyard at the University of Helsinki in Finland is the 7th International Symposium of the Deaf Online Research Network, so DORS number 7. And you attended DORS 6 last year, and we also have a special episode build around that conference. But this year we're going to Finland, and the theme is Digital Deaf, Transforming History, Rituals and the Afterlife. And in terms of paper deadlines, you've got quite a while until April 3rd. You can submit an abstract for a panel, and sometimes papers will be accepted a bit after that. So it addresses the cultural and social transformation of human deaf in modern society as it is characterized by digital saturation of the current collective social and cultural existence. So if you do anything deaf related online, they are looking for papers on the digital afterlife, digital immortality, AI, robotics, Senna technologies, grief influencers, digital resistance and ethical challenges to studying digital death, and much more. So if you've got anything related to that, do submit an abstract, and I would love to be here because it's literally in the place that I live.
Yeah, so you've got to go. I would love to go, but I don't still think I've got any capacity to pay for it. Like the funding at the university I work at for conferences and whatnot is not a huge sum. So I'm not sure I'll be able to do that, sadly. But you never know. Perhaps if we buy the Deaf Studies podcast lottery ticket, all shall come through and I'll be able to make it, because I definitely need to come visit you soon. I've got to come and sit in your sauna.
Forget the conference. We'll just go to sauna for a week. Yeah.
Now, thinking of that sort of time of year, this 4th to the 6th of September 2024, abstracts are open. For one in my backyard, Falmouth University are hosting Deaf Design Culture, Deaf by Design by Culture. And that is working with the Deaf and Culture Network from the University of York. And it's going to be focused on radical reimaginings for the end of life. So it's working with the Department of Graphic Design at Falmouth University and the Deaf and Culture Network at the University of York, also in partnership with the Stamp School of Art and Design in the University of Michigan and the Glasgow End of Life Studies Group at the University of Glasgow. So loads of people working together on this one. It's going to be very interdisciplinary, aiming to support knowledge exchange between researchers in the social sciences, humanities, and design, looking to open up discursive space for traditional as well as practice-based, practice-led research to critically reflect on the role of design as it relates to deaf, dying, and disposal at individual, community, and broader cultural levels. So definitely one, if you're interested in anything to do with design, come along to. It's a lovely space around here and will be really interesting and engaging. I think they're going to do some really cool stuff as part of that as well. So it won't be just a sort of traditional conference, but we'll have some more interesting interactive things going on too. What else have you got, Ed?
Well, I have one in a place I would definitely would love to visit, but I don't think I will be able to attend this one. But it's taking place on Cyprus in November, and it's the 7th International Conference of Photography and Theory, and their theme is Deafscapes, History of Photography and Contemporary Photographic Practices. So I think a lot of people in the field of photography will want to be there. And it wishes to directly engage with what seems to be a contemporary field of crisis and conflict that affects us all and brings forward significant questions that not only are historically relevant and longstanding, but seem to resurface today and are demanding further study and debates. And the deadline for abstract submissions is May 12th. And then the conference, as I said, is November 7 until 9 in Cyprus, which I'm already thinking then in Finland it will be cold again. So let me go to Cyprus.
Oh, cool. That sounds great. Again, we'd love to go. Unlikely, but we'd love to go. The cost of childcare and travel and it all adds up, doesn't it? But hopefully, if some of us go, we'll be able to get some feedback and experiences from that. So if anyone out there listening has got other conferences they're going to this year, or they want to bring anything to our attention, or they want to share info about a conference, do let us know. I'm going to chuck one more in, and that's because I'll be at the other Falmouth one, the Deaf Design one in September, but this one, which is 2nd to the 4th of July 2024, I'm very, very, very honoured to have been asked to give a keynote at. So this one is called Sex, Scandal and Sensation. I just love the title, and it's being run and developed by a wonderful colleague at Falmouth University, Dr. Joanne Parsons, and it's going to have loads of deathy stuff because we've got some great abstracts have come in around graveyards and death in the Gothic and all sorts of stuff about like sensational and scandalous death and dying. And my keynote is going to be entitled, This Was Never Going to Work, Was It? Death Between the Living and the Dead in Film and Television. So I'm going to be looking at texts where there are representations of sexual relationships between the living and the undead. Everything from Twilight to sort of French television series Le Revenant, American Horror Story, some really interesting independent cinema. And yeah, just exploring that idea of what's going on there, what's really happening in these representations, and what are they reflecting and negotiating about people's ideas about relationship.
Yeah.
So if anyone wants to belong to that one, abstracts deadline is closed. So if you've got something desperately want to include, do get in touch. And we'll see if there's any space left. Or I think it's been quite a high level of interest in that one, which is exciting. And there's a couple of other amazing keynotes that are going to be in there too. So do have a browse, have a look online. If you want to come to Falmouth for some sex, scandal and sensation, please do.
Who doesn't? Yeah. Also, your keynote sounds amazing. So if anyone wants to get me to Falmouth in July. And I'm also just so pleased for you that you'll be doing a keynote, Beth, because that is just exciting stuff as well. And who are we talking to today?
Our guest today is hopefully a really interesting, slightly different one. We're going to be talking about music and voice and breath with a vocal coach. So we have, as our esteemed guest this month, Claire Hogan. After completing her GMUS at the Royal Northern College of Music, Claire went on to do a master's by research at Keele University. It was there that she discovered an interest in psychology. While still researching for her MA, Claire started tutoring at Keele and later at Salford University. Claire devised and has run the master's course, Psychology of Performance at Salford, for over 20 years. Claire is an expert in classical and operatic technique and has a keen interest in helping those suffering from anxiety and or stage fright. Her latest book, Performance and Purpose in Death and Dying, was written over 3 years in response to the growing need for a sense of purpose in the wake of so much destruction and devastation, with the aim of communicating the message that there is no death as we commonly perceive it, and there is nothing to fear. It developed and grew from the courses, classes, and the death cafes that Claire's delivered and facilitated. The Alchemy of Performance and Anxiety, Transformation for Artists, Claire's previous book, was published in 2018. Both have been published by Free Association Books. Welcome, Claire, and thank you for joining us. Now, you're a vocal coach and you're a lecturer. Can you please tell us a bit about your background and then how it connects and links to death and dying?
Yes, so I lectured in universities for many years, and I've lectured in the psychology of performance for the master's program, and also as a one-to-one individual vocal teacher for first study singers. And they range in, you know, from classical. My own background is classical singing. I studied at the Royal Northern College of Music and trained as a classical, you might think, anyone might think, opera singer, but it's not just opera, you know, it's any classical vocal work. But in my teaching, over the years, I've taught really any, whatever comes through the door, you know, whatever sort of style of singing they want to do. And so over the years, it has become increasingly more on the like popular music side, and not exclusively at all, is it? Yeah, has it been classical technique? So to explain the link with death and dying, and really that goes to, it's not unconnected to the one-to-one vocal teaching, but it's stems more from the lecturing in psychology of performance on the master's programs, because a great deal of that focused on, and it gradually evolved into a lot of it focusing on the subject of anxiety and performance anxiety and the nature of that. And I created a course to go parallel with that, that was open to any students, not just master's students, and entirely voluntary, but it was a course that addressed performance anxiety for anybody, because you don't have to be a musician and you don't have to, lots of people suffer from it. And so that takes us on to, which is why the word performance comes up in this book, is the nature of performance and how we see it and how we, you know, can address it in order to alleviate anxiety, which some people, more than one might imagine, suffer from, you know, very, very severely, and it really does affect their day-to-day lives. So it started with performing as a musician, and then it really spread into all manner of performance, like just being performing as a human being. And so the first book I wrote was really for that. And so that stemmed from the work I was doing on this subject. And that was called The Alchemy of Performance Anxiety. And I suppose it wasn't that conscious, but I realized I was directing it at those people that I was teaching. And it's something I have to not do anymore. And so it was used then in the universities that I taught at as a sort of core text, really. And so I am answering your question. Out of that book came this book, because in the research for that, and the research included, of course, it included a vast amount of reading and that sort of thing, but it was informed by the teaching I was doing and by the people that I was dealing with and sharing stuff with and the students. So, you know, as is always the case, teachers learn just as much, if not more, from the students. So, and I certainly did. And a lot of issues that came up, because in the parallel course that I wrote, there was a lot of open discussion, which was really the most informative aspect of it. There were discussions about death, but when we're talking about anxiety, and we're trying to explore what the core of anxiety might be, death does come up because we're trying to imagine what's the worst thing that you, what is the worst thing that you think could happen to you? And having said that, it would also come up that when people say it quite flippantly, you know, oh God, I nearly died, or I'd rather die than do this. So, and I know we don't mean it, but it does point to something. I really became much, you know, more fascinated about the process of dying and our perception of it. I think that's really what set me off on that. And that was, you know, quite a long time ago now. So it's still the case. Yes, it hasn't. I don't feel as if I've done that now, I'll do something else. I don't think it will ever stop, really.
So you've in part answered my next question, which is about what inspired you to write that your most recent book, which is entitled Performance and Purpose in Death and Dying. Yeah. So instead, you might just give us a bit of an overview of the book and what it's about and what sort of drove you to want to put that content into a book in addition to your existing work on performance anxiety.
The way the book is, say, structured is five chapters. So, and there is, I didn't really set out with this plan, it just developed into it. So it starts, the first chapter is about denial, and it deals with, explores the very physicality of, yes, dying, but really before the whole business of being a human being and having a body and the problems that having a body can cause and our relationship with our body. It's not one relationship, we have several, but it sort of saying it's not easy. And, you know, not just because it's subject to illness or influences and all of that sort of thing, but there's so many psychological and physical issues that impact it. I think that's probably more so now than it's ever been. I'm not completely sure about that, but what I'm referring to there is people's self-image because of the internet and social media and all that sort of, I mean, it was bad enough without it, but I think it's a whole lot worse with it. It begins with, in the first chapter is called denial. So it begins with what it is we deny, and that the denial of death is, and this is what I'm always saying, is that it happens in life. Whatever your death is going to be like or the dying process, you can find the answers in the way that you live and the way we view our perception of our body. So it starts with the very physicality of humanness and some of the many problems that we have with that, or challenges that we have with that. And then it moves in from there to, as I've just referenced, some perception. And then as the book goes in, it's a sort of arc, really. It becomes increasingly unphysical. And what I mean by that is that it moves in far more into the psychology and philosophy of living and dying and death. So by the time we get to the last chapter, which is on, the title is Purpose, we're really considering attitudes and spirituality, which does not necessarily mean it has to be about religion, but of course I talk about religion because it's relevant for so many people. That's the shape of the book. So it moves from the physical through a sort of arch and into more spiritual, philosophical ways of considering it.
Thank you, Claire. And in your book, you write, as we perform in life, so we might perform in death, and therefore we would do well to rehearse, which is, we thought, quite an interesting idea. You know, in some ways you can rehearse and prepare for death, in other ways you can't. So we wondered if you might talk to us a bit about that notion of death as a performance and how you might be able to prepare for death.
Yes, death isn't always a performance, but the dying process usually is to some degree. And again, nothing is always, because there are so many different ways that you can die. It could be very sudden. We haven't got much of a chance to perform then. So I think that it's best to go back to what I mean by performance. So the notion of performance, what I've been trying to do for a long time is, with regard to others, is to try not to separate it so much. Try not to see performance as something that is occasional and something that we put on a different level of functioning. And therefore, in doing that, we're creating, not for everybody, but more people than not, I would say, we create anxiety and tension and apprehension and all these self-reflective things. And so death as a performance is really just linked absolutely inextricably with the fact that life is, because I'm trying all the way through to say or to show that death is not, it's not a final thing, it's a process just like everything else is, and that performance is a process, and the process of dying is no different to the process of living. Because I know this, I don't want to get too esoteric so soon, but you know, everybody's dying. And so how we address the fact that we're all dying, there's no need to wait until you've got a terminal diagnosis or something awful has happened or you caught something or what are all the myriad things that can cause you to die. I'm suggesting that that performance that we're all engaged in, I mean, we're performing all the time, we're performing now. We even perform when we're on our own much of the time. Because we present something. And so my suggestion here in terms of it being a performance and preparation, firstly, is to confront the reality that it is going to happen. I know that everybody knows that they're going to die, but that there is a resistance to it. And there is an unspoken sense of immortality. Now, I agree, it diminishes as you get older, but we put it off for as long as it's humanly possible. And it's something that we do, I suggest, in our culture, because other cultures don't. Other cultures don't, for one thing, they don't separate their families so much as we do. And so death is, you know, people die, animals die, it's accepted, it's inevitable. But it's not a tragedy. And you know, people don't start whispering. In fact, in some cultures, they do quite the reverse and they sing and chant very loudly. So, you know, we have a lot of the difficulties and resistance that I discuss is quite a Western issue. And it's not the sort of book that's going to explore other cultures. That's a different book in another one. But it is quite a Western thing that we have. And so to get back to how to prepare, first of all, think about it and really dwell on it and think about it and try to imagine it. Try to imagine that you know, oh, there's all sorts of little things that, and they're not so little actually. But for example, I could give you a very specific example because it's the same thing, that there's a very successful exercise that I introduce in the anxiety classes. I'm only calling them that. They're not actually called that. In the anxiety classes. So one of the things is to, so this could be death, but let's consider that it might be death. But they're all lying on the floor and it's all. And I say, now just try and imagine, and it's very easy to do this, the next bit isn't, try to imagine a situation that would make you very, very nervous, really, really anxious, something ghastly that, you know, you just really don't want to be there. You really wish that somebody, the floor would open up or whatever people say. And then instead of trying to tell yourself, you'll be fine, and your friends say, well, you'll be great, and all that nonsense, that you actually stay with it and try to make that feeling of fear worse. So just see how bad you can make it, because we always try to escape. I suggest go head on and meet it and try and make it as bad. You think it's bad now, but it could be so much worse. What is the thing that you dread? What is the worst thing that could happen? Let's imagine that. And it's different for everybody, so I'm not giving them, they're doing it. And of course, it's absolutely awful. But the interesting thing is, and I've never known it to be other than this, the words I say, they're very few, but it's just to encourage people to stay with it, not to just jump up and run off. They stay with it. And what never fails to happen is that they can't do it. They can't sustain the fear and the anxiety. And they try and try and try. And that's why I have to keep saying, you must try and make it worse. If it seems to be slipping away, you've got to just try harder. And so, anyway, to get to the point, it does slip away. And they can't. And And then, of course, the realization is whether people have the words for it or not, is that it's an illusion. It wasn't there in the first place. The fear was there, but the thing that you're frightened of is not real. That it's the fear is real, but the thing that you're fearful of, that's the difference. So things are real, but they're not really the way we think they are. And so that exercise is a great relief to people. They just end up laughing or smiling or, they just say, oh. And then that thing, that dark shadow thing, if you use this as a process, as an exercise, it's lost its power. And so, as you can probably work out, that the death thing, it can be used in a similar way. So this is one possible form of preparation for those people who are particularly fearful and anxious about it. But there are plenty of other things that you can do. And I suggest, for example, podcasts like this, listen to them. Listen to people talking about death. And I really think more and more people are, to make it more of an open discussion. And I think we're coming on to this later, but, things like death cafes and making it part of the conversation and reading, I don't mean my book, but anything. There's stuff there to bring it into your life because, as I'm always saying, that it is part of life. It's part of life every day, and we deal with this every day in little ways. Flowers die, trees die, seasons, all of it is cyclic. The opposite of death isn't life because life just is. The opposite of death is birth, and we can come on to that maybe at another moment, but I'm just really trying to stick to talking about death as performance and strategies to prepare for it. And the strategies that I'm discussing, and nearly all of them, but not all quite, are psychological ones and therefore emotional ones, because that's where the fear is. The fear isn't, what sort of coffin am I going to have? The fear is, how do I feel?
Thank you, Kay. I'm really interested in your exercise where you're asking people to sit with the difficulty of feelings and emotions. And you talked about people imagining, the worst things that could happen. Have you come across situations where people in your classes have already experienced the worst or had really difficult, traumatic, perhaps, experiences where that might kind of provide a different dynamic on that kind of thought experiment?
Definitely, yes. And for those people, there is a difference, but the outcome is... it's not the same, but it's similar, and I'll try to explain that. So when engaging in this form of an exercise, which is it's totally internal and private in that regard. And so what it can do, for some people, of course, they're imagining something that might happen in the future. But for some people, what happens is it brings up something dastardly that's already happened. They don't want to remember. They don't want to go back there. They're really very engaged in trying to get away from it or trying to forget about it. And they would like to, this is obviously just some people, they would like to imagine something else in the future that they dread, but they can't quite get past this thing, this almost like a ghost of an experience. And so those people deal with that then. Do give that the same treatment. If you can't go, if you're stuck, then stay there, because that's the bit that needs, that's where you need to go. And so what happens mostly there is that it really does seem to help them leave it in the past, where they kind of come to just their own personal understanding through their feelings, which is the only thing that's, worth understanding it by, that they're carrying something around and they don't need to. I sometimes use the analogy of you're carrying around a very heavy rucksack and you're not going anywhere. Why don't you put it down? You don't have to keep lugging this thing around. And that's okay, because that's the step one, maybe, as metaphor and analogy that we have to use for so many things. But then it's the experience that matters. You have to experience that intellectualizing it or conceptualizing it is not going to do anything, but it's just a step. And sometimes it's helpful.
Yeah, it's really interesting to reflect on, as it sounds like quite sort of therapeutic work, you know, and in a sort of collaborative space rather than in a one-to-one environment. So it's quite a different thing to think about. Now, one of the other things you talk about in your book is the idea of breath work. So we wondered if you might explain to us a bit about what breath work is.
Well, there's a lot to say here. And breathing is, because we all do it, and because it's dealt with by the parasympathetic nervous system, and all that means is that we do it anyway. You know, we don't make our heartbeat, we don't make our vital organs function. So that nervous system, it takes care of vital organ function. The reason that the breath work is so powerful is because it's the only aspect of that nervous system, that parasympathetic, that let's call it automatic rather than that, the automatic nervous system. It's the only bit that we can willingly or at will interfere with and alter. I mean, you can alter your heart rate, but it's quite hard. Breathing, you can alter in a moment. It can help us to, or enable us to thereby alter the quality of our experience. There are many, many breathing techniques. And in this chapter, I outline about five or six different approaches. And they're not mutually exclusive. They just have a different focus. I mean, I could just give you a few examples. Well, I think let's start with coherent breathing. And coherent breathing is where we measure the intake and the exhalation. And it has, in a very particular way, it's not at all difficult. All of these different techniques that I describe are not difficult, with the exception of one, which I'll come to in a moment. Yes, coherent breathing regulates our breathing, which in turn regulates the heart rate, because they're so linked. And also that the heart sends more information to the brain than the brain does to it. So we're actually, by engaging in this coherent breathing, we are calming everything down. But not just that, because it's not always only about being calm. Sometimes it's not suitable to be calm, but we still would like to be in some degree of control. Coherent breathing helps to activate or stimulate the vagus nerve. So now this is, even if I only talk about one example, let it be this one. The vagus nerve it comes from the word vagrant, so it's a massive nerve, and it from the stem of your skull right the way down to your base of your spine, and it wanders around, so hence the word vagrant or vagabond and all of that. So the vagus nerve, it wanders around and visits all our vital organs, and it stimulates them, and it transmits the benefits of the way the coherent breathing stimulates it and stimulates the relationship between the heart and the brain. Now, it's all a little bit technical, but that's just because I'm explaining it. Nobody needs to know any of this. If you were, say, doing a breathing session with some people or just with yourself, you don't need to know any of this, but it still works. You know, you don't even need to know about the vagus nerve, don't need to know anything about heart-brain relationships and all of that. But this, I'm explaining it now because this is what's happening and this is how potentially powerful breathwork can be. And so, yes, of course it calms you down. If you need calming down, if you don't need calming down, well, then it won't. But what it will do is stimulate the nerve, which then stimulates vital organs. So you might want to know, well, why do I want my vital organs stimulated? Well, because you will function in a better way with whatever it is you do. So just to give you a completely other example, you could ask people why they do this. You get the same result if you plunge yourself, which people do, into very, very cold water. And you might have seen it in gymnasiums, you know, people go swimming, or they do all their stuff in the gym, and then they it's a very narrow, it's like a well, I think, really, but it's very, very cold water. And they come out and they feel absolutely marvellous. That's why they feel absolutely marvellous. It's exactly that. And I dare say they, very few of them know that they're jumping in to stimulate the vagus nerve. That's what's happening. But you can do it far more comfortably with breathing exercises. That's one example. Another example is the Irish guy, I can't think of his name, McGowan, Patrick. It doesn't matter, he's in there. But he did all this marvellous work on the effectiveness of nasal breathing, because many, many people, especially children, breathe through their mouths. And this is really detrimental. And there's a lot of study has been done as to the long-term effects of mouth breathing and the long-term benefits of nasal breathing for your body, yes, but also for your intellectual capacity, which is why it's important for everybody, but it's particularly important for children. The overtone chanting, I think I talk about overtone chanting with Jill Peirce, and that is all about internal resonance. And it's extremely effective and extremely powerful. And this is going to sort of lead me on to the next one, which is, I mean, overtone chanting is tricky, I have to say. I said they were all quite easy, except for two. And you do need somebody. You need someone like Jill Peirce to teach you how to do it. But once you're there, you're there. And you make these rather extraordinary noises. But it has the most fantastic effect on your emotional, spiritual, cycle, everything, really, because it's a bit like coming out of yourself. You know, you come out of, it's not all about you as the individual and the separate person, because you always do this with other people anyway. And I mean, you can then do it on your own, but you learn it with other people. And you're doing something that is so unusual and so outside, but it can almost feel like almost like animal noises. The experience is very, let's say, healing. Even if you don't think you've got anything particularly to heal, or like, I mean, most people do, but you don't have to, but you still feel a great benefit. But it's all done on the breath, that the way that you breathe and where you put the sound, and it's not to be confused with singing. I mean, I am a singer, so that was hard. That's hard for me because I think you have to sing everything, but you can put all that to one side. No one cares what you sound like, really. And then that takes me on to holotropic breathing and breathing technique. And this is Stan Grof and his wife, who is dead now, Christina Grof. And they developed this technique. And this is where I have to say before I go on, I haven't done it. But one doesn't matter, even if it was next door, I'm not sure that I would want to do it for myself. But I suppose I would, in the interest of research, yes, I probably would. But you really are taken out of yourself and you do this. It's like, this is simplifying it massively, but just to try and not take too long, it's a bit like hyperventilation, but it's deliberate. And you have to have somebody with you. You cannot do it on your own because you have to have a carer. And they play very, very, very loud music. It's kind of tribal. And you're doing this hyperventilation. And I think you might be going to ask me about this. This is where we're going into the realms of the transpersonal, because it's a breathing technique that takes the individual beyond the individual. You also said, what has any of this got to do with death? Now, of course, I kind of think it's pretty obvious, but it isn't, I suppose. It's because the power of the breath, and after all, it's the last thing we're going to do. And the way in which we do this thing that we very rarely think about, until it goes wrong, until it's, say, COVID, for goodness sake, there were people there who suddenly thought about breathing an awful lot because they couldn't do it. And so it's got everything to do with death, that it's an awareness, the awareness of our breathing and the awareness of how we can intervene, and the power of the intervening and altering of the way that we breathe and the effect that that has on our entire physiology and psychology. And then just to go a little bit further, it can go into the more spiritual realms.
I'd like to go on a course on some of these breathing techniques and try them out. I'm not sure I'm up for the hyperventilation one either, but it sounds... It's more the loud music makes me kind of like have Guantanamo vibes. I'm not sure I'd torturous, but yeah, really powerful stuff, and I'd like to know more about it. You know, you talk about it really well in your book, and then I get the feeling maybe it's something that benefits from being experienced and being in a space of trial.
And another writer who wrote about the deep sea divers, he wasn't writing about the holotropic thing. He was writing about, he did some research on how deep sea divers, how they're able to hold the breath for so long. It's quite extraordinary. And he thought he'd give this holotropic breath thing a go. I mean, I think he was quite blown away by it. But the point about the holotropic thing is that you're not on your own. You cannot be on your own. It's a thing. And after all, Stanislav Grof, who is still alive, who developed this with his wife, you know, he's a Jungian psychologist, psychiatrist, psychotherapist. You know, he's no fool. He knows what he's doing. And what he is deliberately doing is accessing the transpersonal, accessing the beyond the self. And that's where there is a link between, because I talk about Rupert Sheldrake in both books, actually, and he developed the idea of morphic resonance. Morphic resonance is about that your thoughts, your psyche operates beyond you. It's not confined to your head, your brain.
Elsewhere in your book, you write that there is no need to believe anything or anyone. Peace lies in the knowing which arises from the validity of our own experience. You talk about that in relation to approaching death and dying. So I wondered if you could just explain for us a little bit more what you mean by that idea of peace lying in knowing that could arise only from the validity of our own experiences.
What I'm saying here is that we do contain, or we can find answers that are within us, that not everything that we might want to know or everything that we might want to understand or embrace is outside of us, and that there is no need to believe something, anything at all, let's say blindly. If it can be put to the test. We can put it to the test by finding out, going within ourselves and see what is our experience, what is the actual truth of our existence. And you don't actually have to read a book about it. Now, you might want to read a book about it, and obviously I have and do and et cetera, but anything that you read, anything that anybody preaches to you, I am suggesting, should be made real by your own experience and your own knowing of it, that it needs to be belief itself. For one thing, it isn't going to last, and which is why people go from this to that to another thing, because they wear this out and then they get tired. And rightly so, you would get tired of something because it's external, because it's outside. We should always put ideas to the test. Now, that can sound quite difficult because you might think, well, how do you know what to do? How would I know how to put something to the test? And it's really very simple. Just ask yourself really, really simple, very basic questions, and this will lead to considering, and we'll have to go here, but you know, the reality of past and the reality of future and the reality of our memories and who we think we are. And by self-investigation, we can discover an awful lot of things that we are not. And in that process, we can often divest ourselves of things, practices or routines or systems or belief systems, because they don't serve us. If they don't serve us, there's no point. And so it's really investigating the us or the me or the I that is looking to be served, and questioning it. How does this serve me? and what does it do for me, and what is it assuming that I am, and what do I assume that I am? And it's like a peeling away of layers of stuff. It could be ideas, it could be, yes, beliefs or suggestions, all of those things, whatever we want to call them.
Very interesting. And also, I like what you just said. We should put ideas to the test. And I think maybe our next question is one of those ideas we should put to the test and can be perhaps a bit controversial as well, because you say the truth is that we are immortal and that death is illusory. So could you speak to that? Because I feel I was reading that thinking, I'm not sure how I feel about that or what that means. So could you unpack that a bit for us?
Yes, the illusion begins with what and who we think we are. So we think that we are, I'll keep it to myself, although I don't actually think this, but I'm going to say that as if I do. So I think I am this person, you know, Claire Hogan, I've been alive this long, and my parents were this and da-da-da, and I did this, and my biography and all of that. Well, I'm limited by my biography, let's say, and by my thoughts and feelings and my past and my expectations and my size. That's what's illusory, because that isn't who I am at all. And that's just one finite example of an I, but I'm an I. It doesn't mean that I don't exist. Of course I exist, but not as a separate, finite, and brain-encapsulated thing, so that my being stops inside my head. If that is the case, that I'm not that, then when we're considering dying and death, it's inevitable that we're going to ask, what is it that dies? Who and what dies? Yes, the body is it. Well, it will pack up and go. But the I that's I, that we all are, that we all share, can't possibly die. There's nothing to die. It just is. It just is. And I'm an example of that isness, and so are you, and so is everybody. We're examples. We're specimens, and that's why we're here, and it's what we do with that. But that consciousness, death means nothing to it. It can't, because consciousness is, it's not that we have consciousness, and I do say this in chapter 5, I think I talk about this quite a bit. It's not that we have consciousness, or some people, panpsychists, think, you know, this book has consciousness and the table has consciousness. Well, of course they don't. But consciousness, it's absolutely right that consciousness is everywhere, because it's all there is. It has us. And so that consciousness, death to it, it just, you can't even say it in the same sentence, because it has no meaning. That's what I mean then by that it's illusory. There are many people who think, and this is what they're frightened of. And no wonder they're frightened. Because if you really believe that you are this isolated thing caught inside your head, if you think that your mind is your brain, which of course it isn't, and if you think that your mind is confined to your skull, you're going to be very worried about dying. And it would be very frightening, because your sense of self is totally, totally false. And you're awfully scared of losing it. But the it is an illusion. There is no it. You can't lose it. And if you want to lose, let's call it the illusion, if you want to get rid of that while you're alive, which is what I'm strongly advocating, then that's the best thing you can do. Because if you've got rid of that while you're alive, then you see that there's nothing. There's nothing to be afraid of. You could be afraid. I'm not talking about fear of pain. I'm afraid of pain. I don't want to be in pain. I don't want to have a ghastly illness. I don't want to, you know, be disgusting, or I don't want to be a burden on somebody. All of those things are real, and they're all back to chapter. That's all to do with the body. That's to do with us having to deal with having a body. And it's like, you know, you have a new car and then it wears out and then it's a pain and on. Any physical thing, you could make it as an analogy. But that which occupies it, the consciousness, the being, the I, cannot cease to be. Because if it ceased to be, now this is bonkers, but it will make it, I hope, clear. If it ceases to be for one of us, then it will be for everybody. We'll all be gone. And so will the world, as we see.
So if I understand you correctly, you are suggesting and arguing that we are part of a bigger whole. So our bodies as individuals might die, but a bigger, whatever you want to call it, exists that connects us all, which probably also leads us nicely to the next question we're going to ask you, is your interest in transpersonal psychology. Does that match those ideas of that we are bigger than our bodies or individual bodies, etc.?
Yes. So I touched on that just earlier when I was talking about holotropic breathwork and Stangrove, but transpersonal psychology isn't confined to that. It sounds a bit, you know, remote, and it isn't at all. We engage in it, maybe not, well, psychology, but without the terminology. When we think that this, there are three states, our waking state, our dreaming state, and a deep sleep state. Let's just keep it to three for the sake of this. When we go to sleep, we're not afraid. We like going to sleep. But when we go to sleep, whether we're dreaming or whether we're in deep sleep, we don't have any awareness of our bodies. We don't know where we are. We don't care particularly because if we're asleep, you might say, well, if you're in an awful place, you know, if you're in a bunker in Ukraine, you would get, yes, but then you probably wouldn't be asleep. So we don't want to go down those rather silly avenues. Let's say you're nicely at home and you're in your bed and you go to sleep. And then you have a dream. Now, there are lots of different levels of dreams. Sometimes we have a dream and it's a bit autobiographical. You know, it's about our day or it's about something in our past. You know, we can identify the drama and the players. And other times we have dreams that in no way does it have anything to do with any experience that we've had. We don't know where it's come from. They can be violent or they could be beautiful, but they're outside our waking experience. In other words, they've come from somewhere else. And we might, for a short while after we wake up, think, oh my goodness, that was extraordinary. I wonder what that was all about. How on earth did I ever, you know, have a dream about this? But I would say within about, occasionally a bit longer, but within about 20 minutes, it's gone. You know, we're not absolutely overwhelmed, but you've had a transpersonal experience. And what that means is our brain, so that mix up the brain, mind, consciousness, we have filters. Of course we have filters, because if we didn't have filters, we couldn't cope. We couldn't possibly cope with seeing the world as it actually is. Well, the universe as it actually is. It is unimaginable. Of course it's unimaginable. So we need these filters so that we can operate. For example, when we go to sleep, so these filters relax to some degree, and that degreeness is critical. And if it's only a little bit, then you probably have, let's just call them regular day-to-day dreams. If they dissolve more or if they relax more, then you have experiences that you know they don't belong to your waking experience. They come from somewhere else. Now, if you take psychedelics, and people think that they often say, oh, you know, that my mind it expanded and it was amazing and they can't describe it and it's just, it can be good or bad. But what actually happens is that those filters, they contract. So you have fewer filters. That's why the universe, the world, it's allowed in. It's not that your mind isn't expanding, your brain isn't expanding, it's contracting and allowing more in. And so this transpersonal, that's what it is, transpersonal experience, we already have it. It varies in degree and it varies in person, but it varies within each of us. Of course it does. And I'm not advocating psychedelics. I'm only using them as an example of that might be relatable to some people. That's all. And even when we're in deep sleep, we don't have an experience, but you still, the thing that never, ever goes away is your awareness. It just hasn't got anything to be aware of. And so there's nothing to remember, but it hasn't gone because there's nowhere for it to go.
I am wondering, because you were talking about filters, and in your book, you talk a bit about not wanting to use particular religions or belief systems as a starting point. Do you see those as the types of filters that we also view the world with? Because you have a very particular viewpoint trying to embrace all of this without starting with a certain belief system. And I was personally wondering, how can you remove yourself so much that you start this conversation? Because I feel we're always filtered by something. So how do you have this conversation around death and dying by stripping away all belief systems and ideas?
This could really be linked to the subject of ritual in the way that one can adopt. It's not really the same as adopting a belief system, because as you know, I'm saying don't do that. But what I'm not saying, don't engage in practices, activities, rituals, if you find them either useful or enjoyable or valuable in some way. Because after all, the only reason that we want to do anything is because we get some valuable emotional experience out of it, or a psychological benefit. Those two things are what we want in all things, you know, whether it's buying a pair of shoes or going to a funeral or whatever it is. More about funerals in a minute, but that's slightly different to buying a pair of shoes, obviously. But there is a link in that we are always looking for valued emotions and psychological benefits in whatever it is we do. So one can very comfortably operate in the world without a belief system that you're, if you like, signing up to, but you can still engage in certain activities. So to illustrate it with myself, I am a Buddhist, but I am, and I do Buddhist things. But I do them, I engage in them for the times I engage in them, because I get psychological benefits in Buddhism, but I engage in them because they are an example of what I feel that I know. Really, the non-duality, which is what everything that I'm saying is about, that's what Buddhism is an example of. So it's not that I need it. I don't need it. But it's a very good platform for living well. It's a good framework for questioning one's motives and for the journey, the pathway of being, thinking well and speaking well and behaving well. And it's useful and it's pure. It's very, very pure. And it's not, you probably know all this, there's no God. We don't have to believe in God. You don't have to not believe in God. You don't have to do any of that stuff. So it's an activity that I choose to participate in terms of, I study it, I have a weekly, very intense tutorial, one-to-one tutorial about its philosophy. But I don't see it as that's the only thing there is. Of course it isn't. Of course it isn't. And I don't need to have anything. But it is a choice that I make. Now, somebody else might choose Christianity. And although I rejected that hugely in my adolescence, but that was because of my upbringing. But I'd now come round and seen that what I rejected wasn't really, it was the trappings and the nonsense of Christianity. But the pure mystical Christianity is pure and mystical. And so You know, it's what people do with it and how they sail it and destroy it.
Hearing you talk about ritual and what people do, I think it's a bit of a bridge, but I'm going there anyway. One of the things you also facilitate are death cafes, and I think it's the first time we are talking about death cafes on the podcast. So could you explain briefly what they are and why you facilitate them?
Death cafes are it's a thing in the sense that if somebody wants to facilitate a death cafe, you must subscribe to their outline and their, it's like an organization. I don't mean it's an organization that it's in a building on a road. It isn't. It's just as you subscribe to, you agree to abide by the guidance of it. And it's very, very, very good guidance. And so what death cafes do, I'll describe how I started doing it. So I did all that. And so then this is quite a long time ago now, I used to go to a cafe. It literally is a cafe, but you go to a cafe and you ask them, would you mind if I did this? And so the rules are, so you advertise it somewhere, and or you just make it known because it tends to build up itself. And then say a few people would come to this cafe. I mean, you can't take over the whole place, but you sit around a table. They must buy their coffees and stuff from the place. But then, and it lasts about somewhere around an hour and a quarter, roughly. And we sit around and I guide it. Well, that's the word facilitator, isn't it? And we talk about, I have some, you know, pertinent questions. And then it's just a very, very open conversation about dying and death. And I have to, you're very good at facilitating, so you'll know what I have to do. You have to make sure somebody doesn't give you their life story, or you have to make sure, you know, that you get people that dominate and other people don't. And that's the skill, I suppose. But also to steer it so that you don't end up talking about something else entirely. What is so interesting, what I have found, so of course I had there was a big hold up for over COVID because I never got more of that later. It's not interesting, but I didn't get to do the online version of it. It could be done very easily, and I'm sure it was, but I didn't do that because I had so much other online teaching to do. What's so interesting, when I first started, I imagined, I suppose, that it would be a lot of old people. And there weren't any. I never had any old people. It was all young people. All people, maybe partly because I taught in universities, but it wasn't just that. A very diverse group. And just absolutely, I think every single one, people, I found it fascinating. Everybody found it fascinating. And the things that were said and the openness of it and the things people felt free to say and free to talk about what they're afraid of and to hear each other. It's not about me or the facilitator. That really is your role, is to make the discussion for the people to talk to each other, including me. And I think they're absolutely marvellous. So it is, you go to a cafe, you set it up with the cafe, you advertise it, it happens, and that's how it works.
Brilliant. And then we have one final question for you, which we ask all of our guests, and that is, we love a bit of advice. So do you have any advice?
It would be this, because to address, if we want something to change, it has to be our perception. And to change our perception of death is to see it, to see that and really see it everywhere. You don't have to wait. It's just that most people do wait. We don't have to wait. It's to embrace it as part of life. We are surrounded by it. It's cyclic, and it's birth and death. That's the pair, and one leads to another. Death leads to more life. Birth and death are the pair. Life just is. It isn't. We say this phrase, oh, it's a matter of life and death. Of course it isn't. Of course it isn't. Life just is. Consciousness just is. You know, and we can see that and really welcome it and see that when the body does die, it is to sort of see it as it's an adventure, really. And there's a wonderful, wonderful philosopher. You may know of him, Bernardo Castrop, and he uses this great sort of image of rivers and whirlpools. And so the river being, say, the continual everlasting flow of consciousness, and we're like a little whirlpool, and then the whirlpool, it expands. So when we die, it's a bit like I was talking about filters, they go. Our brain filters go. So then we rejoin, the ripples get bigger and we go off downstream and rejoin the river. And we'll come and form another whirlpool maybe again, and it'll be mixed up with other whirlpools, and it is an adventure. And that would be, I don't know that it's advice, but it certainly will. Changing one's mind is the only advice there is. It can be the only advice there is. And that's a good way to change it, is to see death as a gateway to more life.
Do you know, I actually found that quite an emotional episode listening back. I think because I do experience quite a lot of anxiety. And as you know, like around my body as well, I get quite worked up about like things happening in my body that I'm maybe like, oh, what's going on? I always want like an answer for things. And listening to this idea that, like, especially because I'm not religious, so a lot of what I read resonates a lot with what Claire was talking about around the idea of, like, you know, life just is, and the idea of people being water and a sort of death as a gateway to more life, and you just re-entering that is very similar to a lot of stuff that I've read before. Really nicely resonated with you. And we're both big fans of Rob Delaney, the comedian whose son died. And in interviews, he's talked a lot about that kind of metaphor of water and stuff as well. So I really, really enjoyed listening to it all, thinking about myself as an illusion that I am far too attached to. I'm far too attached to my own eye, and I know it. But at the same time, I was like, I was surprised that even though it wasn't necessarily like a grief focused episode, ones that usually get me really teary, like it really did hit like something in my mind. I was very aware of my feelings in my body as I was listening to it and thinking, where am I feeling that? How was it for you?
I found this episode also listening back very moving. I also have to admit, having the conversation with Claire on the day, I found it very challenging. And while she was talking, I was trying to wrap my head around some of the things that she was saying and like, what does it mean? And it's still, I think, like the transversal psychology, and that what I found particularly fascinating, because I feel I've experienced that myself as well, is having very vivid, strong dreams or images that I see that I think, where does my brain get this from? Because they don't feel like my experiences. And to then have someone like Claire say, oh, that might be that you're tapping into other people or other creatures, or because we're all too connected and all woven together. And again, perhaps because I'm also quite attached to myself as an individual kind of thing, I find that very interesting and challenging, and also just, yeah, terribly fascinating.
I thought it was interesting that her advice was that the only advice you can give is to change your mind. It's the only advice that there is. I've been pondering that. I'm not sure I agree with it. I don't know. What do you think? Give advice beyond to change your own mind, change the way your mind experiences the world. Or can you give advice that's more like change your actions? I don't know.
Yeah, I would unpack what changing your mind would mean and in what situation and how, because I think the bigger question that's behind is just, how do you perceive the world? How do you take in new information, new stories, new ideas? That's at least the way I live my life. If I get information that, like this episode, that is challenging me or is hitting at something. I think, oh, I've never thought about it this way, or oh, that is interesting, or like you just, oh, I don't think I agree with that. I think that's, for me, the message is to stay attuned to that and to not just reject those ideas, but to sit with them and mull them over, and then perhaps still reject them, but or perhaps they change your way of thinking.
Yeah, I definitely found some of the ideas quite challenging, and I think it will be a challenging episode for a lot of people, because if you do have a different way of seeing the world, a different way of thinking about the world, and I think certainly some of the ideas around thinking that when death happens, you might not mind at all, which is kind of how the book is marketed, is like when it does occur, you know, you mightn't mind at all that it will. I don't know why I find it so hard, because I am sort of, I really resonated with what she was saying around what are you actually afraid of. I ask myself that a lot, like, what am I actually afraid of? And it isn't dying. It's lack of control, not being able to do the things I want to do, existing in a state that I fear would not bring me joy or sense of reward, those kinds of things. Like unpacking all the time, I think, is really useful, and it's sort of all you can do. And then at the same time, reminding yourself that all you have is now, like the only time you have access to is the right now. And that's easier said than done a lot of the time.
I wrote down the phrases that she said around death is not a final thing, and it's a process, and it's a performance. Again, I've been thinking about that. It's not a final thing, but for who or what? Is that a sense of that we all just live on forever, but in a different form? Or if it's a performance, the way I have thought about performing and like playing a role and stuff is perhaps more based on sociological theories, like that we all perform, and what's his name? It's Irvin Goffman, that we front stage and backstage, but even in your private backstage, we all play a role. And she was saying similar things, but I felt also more in how we perform our bodies, and like, well, just also how she was breaking down breath work and how we are and our body language. I think there are so many levels and layers of performance. So that is one of the things that I've been thinking about as well. Like, how does that work? Like, how are we performing? And also, again, not thinking about whether is that good or bad, or is that just, again, it's just something that is, we all are performing, but who are we then performing for? If no one is watching, but also if we're all connected, then someone or something might still be watching. So it's again this play with more atheist, but also if there's someone out there watching. So again, it's these things, like I also don't believe in God or anything, but I do have this sense of we are connected in some way or form with each other, that there is more.
Well, I hope that other people listening got something from it. What I would say is do get in touch with us. You can leave comments on the podcast episode wherever you listen. Usually you can leave either a comment or a review. We always love to hear from listeners. You can email us at thedeathstudiespodcast@gmail.com. and also a massive shout out thank you to those of you who responded to our plea to buy some merch on social media the other day. We sold quite a few sweaters and nice couple of donations and badges and things being bought as well, and we really appreciate it. It means an absolute great deal to us, so thank you very, very much, and catch you next month.
Thank you for listening to the Death Studies podcast. You can find out more about our guests and their work in the show notes or on our website, thedeathstudiepodcast.com. If you enjoyed listening to us, please leave us a comment, follow us on social media, and of course, spread the word.